Hi, I'm Donna, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And it's a pleasure to be here today to share my experiences this week on steps 1, 2, and 3. I'm not going to go into a drunkalog, but my drinking and my drug use enabled me to see that I needed to live a different kind of life. Right before I surrendered, and I didn't realize that I was surrendering, I've been separated from alcohol 11 years. And right before I had this moment of clarity, I knew that trying to live a sane life and be like other people was starting to fall apart. I couldn't pull it off anymore that I was an alcoholic and a drug addict. At the time I knew I had a problem with drugs, I had no idea that I had a problem with alcohol. The first time I drank alcoholically, I was about 11 years old, and my parents went to a party with other parents, and it was a New Year's Eve, and we were all in the basement drinking, and I passed out. So even at the age of 11, I never knew how to say, oh, I've had enough. The next time I remember drinking alcoholically, when I was in high school, and I wound up on the bed with the coats. And nobody wanted to take me to my door because no one wanted to hear the wrath of Marguerite and Lloyd, my parents. I grew up very insecure. I worried about what people thought about me. I wore glasses, and that was the albatross around my neck. I hated wearing glasses. I mean, it really bothered me. My ego was so big that anytime anybody criticized me, I felt like I was going to die. And alcohol, and at that time, marijuana, made me feel okay. And it also enabled me to find other lost souls like myself. I was a bully. I felt that for me to have a false sense of power was to me to pick on people that I felt was weaker than me. I have since gone back and made amends. I was terrible. My way of acting out and feeling better was to hurt other people. Hurt people. I see that now in my mom. She hurt because she hurted. But, you know, when you're growing up, you don't think that way. And of course, I thought that I always had to have my way. And if I didn't have my way, I was very arrogant. I've come to learn that fear doesn't always present itself as fear. It usually presents itself differently, like arrogancy. And I was very arrogant, like, you know, F you. And so I got through school. I always was a fraud. I was a fake and a fraud because I can speak fairly good English as an African American. I played on that. You know, I can speak well. And meanwhile, no one knew that I was a crackhead. I guess they did know, you know, because I always wore a baseball cap. You know, and had sunglasses, and I was such a manipulator. I would go to work, and I would love for you to ask me what was the matter, so I could do like this. I didn't feel good. I mean, I didn't feel good because I'd been up all night, you know, and that was the easy way for me to get out of work and start the party again. I had moved to South Bend, Indiana. I was very good about making geographic moves on a whim. I met a guy who was an artist. And I met him when he was here in New York, vacationing for 2 weeks. I fell in love. I packed up all of my things, and I moved to South Bend, Indiana. At this time, I was living with a girlfriend of mine, very talented artist, and her house was so filthy. We were living on 2nd Avenue that we had to put matchbooks on top of beer cans because of all the varmints, the things that would go in the can. I mean, that's how I was living. We couldn't find her cat because it was so filthy. Her cat had died in the apartment. So when this guy said, listen, you know, I'll come live with me, he had no idea that I was bringing everything that I owned. Stayed there, and he had a problem with alcohol, so it was perfect for me because I didn't have anybody to tell me that I shouldn't drink so much. That didn't work out, so I stayed in Indiana for 10 years. I had my own life. I was working. I had a job. At this point, all of my jobs were surrounded around alcohol. I got a job working in a fine dining restaurant. I was a banquet manager, and I would go in the back and guzzle the wine. Perfect for me. When I didn't have any money, I would steal their toilet paper. You know, it was great. But that, I started to see that there was a pattern. I never really let on to my parents that I had a problem with alcohol and drugs, but I hit my first bottom, and I say first bottom because there was another one after that. And that was the first time that I admitted that there was a problem that I had, but I really wasn't willing to stop. I had a woman drive me to New York, and I went to a detox. I didn't come to the rooms of AA. I was separated from alcohol 17 months before I stepped in the rooms of AA. I went to a treatment facility, and it was behavioral modification. I've come to realize that I cannot modify my own behavior. And the only time I did that was when I wanted something. If I didn't want them to take my pass, I was going to be honest. But it was always because it was something in it for me. You know, I never knew how to be honest for the sake of being honest. And I went through that for like 17 months, and I still didn't know what I had just gone through that was going to keep me away from an alcohol or a drug. And I started getting panicky when I was about to graduate this facility, and I was like, oh my God, like I've never had a problem getting a job. Thank God. I mean, I went through job training because for the last couple of years of my life, I really wasn't current on a lot of computer software. So I'm very grateful for the program, you know, got dentistry done and all that. I started going to AA because I had to get out of this insane environment. It was insanity. It was so much untreated alcoholism. The people that were thieves, liars, cheaters, they were that in treatment. They just weren't drinking and weren't using. But then again, some people were still drinking and using in treatment. I had a willingness. I'll go back to the August 5th of 2000, and I won't forget that day because it was a hot day. I had come from Harlem where I was hanging out because I went where the drugs were up on in Washington Heights. And I had 50 cents in my pocket once again. And I didn't know whether I was going to buy a Lucy or a cigarette. Lucy beer. And sometimes the beer won out, sometimes the cigarette won out. But this particular day, I remember walking down the block and I knew that I had enough. I didn't know what I had enough of, to be honest with you. I didn't think that I was an alcoholic. I was just tired of my life. I was tired of going to work with no sleep, being on the subway, thinking that this was my lot in life, going to work with no sleep, and constantly borrowing money, and then manipulating before I went to bed how I was going to get out of this jam again. And I remember there were times I would be laying in the bed like this. Like, oh shit. Like, oh my God, like panic stricken. But that never stopped because I was always panic-stricken, and once I got through whatever I was going to go through, I got through that day, I was back again. This particular day, I had stolen some jewelry off of this dude that was in this place we were getting high at, and I thought they were coming after me, and I ran from 145th Street down to 125th Street, and I knew that this is not how I was raised. And I walked down the block, and I said, it was like, I bowed my head and said, I can't do this anymore. And I tell you, I am convinced 11 years later that the obsession to drink was lifted. I had a willingness that I never had before in my life to stay stopped. My mother was sitting on the couch like she always was, afraid to ask me if I was high because I was going to do one of two things. I was going to lie, and that was going to kill her, or I was going to tell her the truth. And that was going to kill her. And I walked past her and I said, Mom, I'm done. And I went upstairs and I knew at this point, I just went through the phone book. So I know it wasn't of me. And I went through the phone book seeking help and I knew that, wow, this is really serious because I had no ID. I lost that in the cab going. I loved after hours. I got to be honest with you. I loved the life. I loved getting out of the clubs. Hey! You know, my transvestite friends and everybody's going to work and carrying on. You know, it was like I hated the end because I always left when I had no money. And I would pull money out of my pocket and they would be like crumpled up because I just had no concept. I never valued my apartments. I can't say that I lost things because of getting high. I gave them away. I never valued my apartments. I never wanted to pay the rent. I was so sneaky, I would put the check in the mail, and I wouldn't sign it because that would give me more time. So I went to Beth Israel, and I knew that I was serious because I didn't need anybody to drive me. See, usually I would always, one of my outs was if I didn't have anybody to drive me, I wasn't going. But this time I got on the train and I went to a rehab and I had no idea what I was doing. It seemed like there had been people that had been through this before. And I've had more than once people ask me, am I willing to go to any length? When I was in this treatment facility, in this rehab, this 10-day rehab, people came in from AA, but I still didn't connect with me. So I went away, and somebody said, are you willing to go to any length and go to this long-term therapeutic community? And I got to be honest with you, along my path, God has put people in my path to guide me. This wasn't a 12-step program, but the counselor gave me an NA book. He said, Donna, before you get on the bus to go down to reentry, I want you to take this book out of my desk. My first AA book when I was in reentry was The Nurse, and it's the same AA book that I have today, still was given to me. So I started going to AA on Columbus Avenue and 96th Street, first things first. And I got to be honest with you, the reason why I was going to AA was not because I was dying to come to AA, but because I needed to get out of this insanity that I was living in. But when I went to the meetings in AA, I realized that there was something different. See, where I was at, it was uncaring. You know, when it was time to set up the room, nobody wanted to get up and help. But I walk into AA, and I felt this warmth. And thank God, they just let me sit in there and cry. I sat in the rooms, and I just cried, and I cried. And then I ran into this woman. And see, I was very cognizant of people who looked different than and looked like they felt different than I did. They had a peace about them. They weren't sharing like they were too cheap to go to therapy. I was waiting for that. And so again, I was asked that question: was I willing to go to any length? This woman said, "Donna, are you willing to go to any length, never to drink again?" And I had not been hearing that in AA. I had been hearing, "We don't drink for today." And I'm like, "Oh my God, I cannot worry about not drinking every day." In 11 years, the thing that I've always held on to was willingness and an open mind and an honest desire. And those three words or three phrases are in our big book. And so while I was in this treatment facility, I was spending my weekend passes at a big book workshop with a couple, Loretta and Sydney from Harlem, that had taken many alcoholics and addicts to the big book. And so I sat in this big book workshop, and I just felt like, oh my God, I finally found out what my problem was. And I tell you, I don't know whether I never knew that I would be in a position to help others, but everything that Loretta said, I wrote. You didn't have to ask me to write it. Wrote it. Highlighted, wrote it. And so while I was, I think I was starting my amends, and God started sending me people to work with. And I remember I was reading with people sitting in, there was a coffee shop on 3rd Avenue and 17th Street where I worked. And there was always this table in the back that was available. And I said, Loretta, I can't take people through, I'm not done. This is not, if you're a chapter ahead of them, you can take them through. And that's what I did. I had to be convinced that I had no power. See, if I thought that I had anything to do about me staying stopped, I was not going to move into step two and be willing to turn my will and my life over to anything. So I had to examine the evidence and see that the best that I can do on my own was junk. I thought I was this great big such a much. I want nothing. I wanted you all think that I was this hot chick, but that's not how I was living. That's not how I was thinking. That's not how I was behaving with people. You know, when I at work, I always needed an assistant who wasn't as smart as me, wasn't as attractive as me, so I can feel good about myself. See, I know I've been inwardly reorganized because I'm a totally different human being today. It's about what I can give to help. I realize that the highest attainment in AA is to be a servant of God. So I knew that I couldn't. You know, this to me, this is about crushing my ego at every turn. You know, my mind lied to me, and it continues to lie. But I had to see how my mind lied to me about alcohol. You know, the times that I tried to commit suicide, it couldn't let me see the truth about that. So I knew that I had to have a different God, because this one did not have my best interest at heart. It keeps me in a place of fear, doubt. So I was willing to believe. So I examined the evidence. The writers of the big book gives us 4 chapters on step one. Are you now convinced? You know, I love when I work with people, and they're so eager to read every week, and then they want to know if I can read 2 times a week. See, I don't buy that anymore, because when we get to steps 4 and 9, all of a sudden, I can't find you. I'm like, look, we got an hour this week. This is the day. Because we're so used to wanting what we want. I also don't want anybody to rely upon me, because I'm not anybody's God. So that decision that I made, I remember my first honest prayer, because I realized what I was about to do. I was about to let go. And I felt like it was like jumping off of a cliff. And I remember praying, going, Father, I'm willing to believe, but are you going to be there to catch me? And see, thank God for the recovered people that are in our lives, because, you know, I can't have faith until I'm willing to believe. You know, it's just like you take a computer to get fixed. You know, if you've never taken this equipment to be fixed, you don't have faith that the guy's going to fix it. You're willing to believe that he's going to fix it. So when he fixes it, you can go back again on faith. So I was willing to believe Loretta and Sydney and all these people that had been before me that did this work that seemed inwardly reorganized. And I prayed, and I was like, wow, like I want to jump, but will you catch me? I also realized that, you know, we put our lives in the care of God. And you know, so this God that my concept was a very loving God, you know, and I love, you know, all the wonderful exercises that I've been given, because I've gone through the work a few times. The last time, which was the most powerful, was when I went through the big book with an Al-Anon sponsor. Wow. I got a chance to see that I still had some old ideals I had to let go absolutely, or the result was still going to be nil. And so, you know, I and I'm sure some of you have done this exercise in the second step, where you take all those spiritual terms and you go into meditation and you ask yourself, what do those terms mean to you? And you'd be surprised. You may not think that you have a concept about God. Maybe the word God might trip you up. But, you know, creator of the universe, I'm sure that you might have a wonderful, wonderful experience of what that means to you. And so what I did after I wrote what those concepts meant to me, I read it all in one big old paragraph. My God was big. Wasn't relying on it. And I went to Catholic school all my life, and I must have missed religious instruction when they said it's about reliance. I never knew. That when I'm in that moment where there's fear, where there's doubt, where this mind of mine wants to keep me in bondage, I just have to be still. All my life I was controlling, trying to fix, being mad, being frustrated. When we get to steps 10 and 11, I'll share, I went to a 10-day silent retreat where I couldn't speak for 10 days, and I tell you, I realized that the mind is like a 2-year-old. Runs away, it stays out here. So of course, all my life, I thought my happiness was contingent upon what's going on out here, because that's where my mind always takes me. That's why the world and its people had power over me. For me to cut my hair, I did this 5 years ago. I could never have cut this, but I didn't feel the power within. I realize now that, you know, hair is a accessory that I don't need. Now, it also helps I've got a great shaped head, but this is a direct result of how I feel about myself today. I had to see the truth and the lie, that I am worthy, that I am deserving, that I'm not a F up. Yeah, I was willing to believe all the things that people had thought about me, and I was so busy trying to make people feel comfortable that I was downplaying who I was so you can feel good. What the heck? Oh, she thinks she's cute, so then I'm going to act like I'm not cute. Because I don't want to hurt, because I care about what you think about me. So I got a chance to see a lot about myself. I always say that the first three steps are the most important, because if I don't really surrender to all three beliefs, I'm not going to move into the action steps. My mind is not going to want me to see the truth. It doesn't want to be crushed. It always wants to rebuild itself. But, you know, we work with others. You know, we look at our truth. You know, see, I never looked at my truth. It was always everybody else's fault why I was the way I was. When they say that alcohol put me into submission, it did. When I stop like this, is 20 minutes up? Okay, thank you.